You can imagine how shocked I was when last night around midnight, Ed called me and asked me to give away Seeking Mind Talk. Out of the clear blue sky, oh my God, how can I be prepared for this? Anyways, I'm just going to wing it. Bear with me. While I was supposed to be meditating, I kept thinking about things that I wanted to add. So I thought of kind of a theme that ran through my talk. And that was, like a lot of you know, that I'm kind of a numbers guy. When the bill comes, I already know what the total is and how much everybody owes. Anyways, today I thought today the number was 2003. And that's what happens when you add up 1,000 joys, 1,000 sorrows, and the 3 refuges. And I'm going to figure out some way to link these together. I don't know about everybody else, but for me, the 1,000 joys are easier than the 1,000 sorrows. And that's where the 3 refuges come in. And I was thinking that the Sangha part is pretty easy, the idea of friends and loved ones to help us through difficult times. And the Dharma part, well, that's what we study, the wisdom of the ages. The Buddha part, it was always confusing to me. But I think it means that a human being is capable of living with the 1,000 joys and the 1,000 sorrows. The ability to be able to appreciate the 1,000 joys and to somehow get through the 1,000 sorrows, hopefully with equanimity and with learning, with lesson. So that was the part that I erased from my talk, but while I was sitting, I decided to add. And I realized that my story is a lot about the refuges. And I'll get going to my personal part now. I grew up in Skokie, Illinois, that was so Jewish that when a Jewish holiday rolled around, they just closed the school because there was nobody left. Like almost all my other friends, I went to Hebrew school to prepare to get bar mitzvah. And I think for most of the kids, it went one ear, went through in one ear and out the other. But for me, we were taught to do a morning and evening prayer, which really was about being grateful for each new day. And I don't know why as a 9 or 10 year old, it sunk in, but it became a habit of something that I did, and I've been doing it all my life. And also, there was a sense in the prayer of wishing others well, we're hoping that your family would be well, that the sick would be healed, and I feel like that was the beginning of creating a refuge. The idea that at least twice a day there was a place where you didn't feel totally helpless. There was a place where you could do something about what was around you in your life, and that maybe it made a difference, but it kind of felt good to do it in any case. And when I was about 10, a couple of years into my Hebrew school training, my aunt became very ill, and here I was, a 10-year-old, saying, "What can I do?" And I prayed for her to be healed, right? Naive, maybe, idealistic, but I kind of made a deal that Made a deal. Did I make a deal with God? Well, maybe that's what I thought at the time, that that if she got better, I would continue to say my prayers and keep kosher. And also not work on Saturday, which is it's in the Ten Commandments. I don't know why, but it is. And when she recovered and lived 20 more years, I kind of felt like I had made a deal. And I was stuck, you know what I mean? It's like, there must have been hundreds of times where I said, do I have to still do this? And I'm not sure quite whether I was afraid of the wrath of God, but I made a deal. And so I've stuck with it over the years, over the decades, over the half a century. But I do feel like it was a lucky break in that it was a refuge. It was something that I did, and it was a practice. It's a practice like I started when I was 10, luckily, instead of whenever else everybody else started. And I made a comment and wrote down this stuff in the middle. The idea of not working on Saturday, I think, has also been an important part of my practice. Of course, I don't work on a lot of other days too, but especially I don't work on Saturday. The idea that in Judaism it's a day where you're supposed to be with your family, or whether you're supposed to be studying, or you're supposed to be just enjoying life and not working. And I think in our culture, we forget that, and people work 87 days straight, and the idea of having 6 days on and 1 day off is important. And I think the idea of a sabbatical where you take 1 year out of 7 off is all the same kind of idea of, it's not all about work, it's about spiritual growth, it's about enjoying the world. That's part of the Thousand Joys part. Like I said, I never had any problem with the Thousand Joys. And also I think that the things like keeping kosher and sticking to these rituals helped me develop a certain amount of self-control. Even as a kid, to say, I'm not going to eat that cheeseburger. Tempting, but has meat and milk together, right? Or I'm not going to eat oysters, which Sarah insists is a great gift, and that I really should make an exception for oysters. But I haven't. And I think the practice has made me who I am. It's a degree of self-control and austerity in my life, which is mostly about pleasure seeking and appreciation. So, anyway, on my 15th birthday, we were still living in Skokie, we packed up the Chevy and we moved from Skokie, Illinois to Encino, California. Swimming pools, movie stars, a view of the entire San Fernando Valley from the pool. Now, this was a miracle. All my friends back in Skokie were pretty much expected to get good grades, go to Ivy League schools, become lawyers or doctors or commodities brokers, whatever that is exactly, I'm not sure. But even at that age, I wasn't really sure why I was so glad to leave town. But I think I felt that I would have more options when I got someplace else, because there's just something about it didn't appeal to me. And so we moved to California, and there was just more joy. And people had convertibles, and people went to the beach after school. And I think there was a whole I just a sense of more possibilities, that you could become something else. And if and not a lawyer or a doctor, at least you can go into the movie business and write scripts or something like that. It's probably hard for you all to imagine, but I was something of a sarcastic, cynical kid, in spite of my already incredible depth. And I was always going for a laugh with a one-liner. In spite of these charming traits, I eventually had a girlfriend, and I often remember a conversation that I had with her. I asked her, "Why don't we get together with your friends? It's always just you and I." And she says, "My friends don't like you. You're mean, and you say things that are hurtful." And for me, this was one of the first duh moments where I said, I had no idea. I just was always trying to be funny. And I think I was being funny at other people's expense sometimes. When I look back, I think it was one of those moments where there was a life lesson here. I maybe didn't learn it immediately, but that there was something else besides getting a laugh. I wrote down a quote here that the Dalai Lama was once asked what he thought the effect of his fame was on Buddhism around the world. And he said, "Doesn't matter. My religion is kindness." And that one of those things that had an impact on me. Ultimately, like we've talked, Michael and I have talked about so many times, loving kindness is what you want to get back to when in doubt. And this was the first right in my face moment of, oh, people don't like me because I'm mean. God, I could do better, I think. When I was when I came up to the Bay Area to go to college at Berkeley, Nixon was busy expanding the war in Vietnam, and the campus closed down, and all the classes became something else. And my introduction to psychology class, try to imagine me as a psychologist, folks. That class became Introduction to Meditation, and the teacher taught us to say St. Francis of Assisi's prayer, the one that includes "It is in giving that we receive." And so I have a feeling that he wasn't a strict Buddhist, but I learned to meditate with that prayer, and saying it thousands of times probably became the most important thing I learned that year. I'm a firm believer, if you're going to sit there for 40 minutes and meditate, you might as well fill your head with something that you can take with you and that that teaches you something. Of course, it was Berkeley, it was 1969. There was drugs, there was sex, there was rock and roll. It was a good time to think about a different way of looking at life, that you didn't have to follow that path that everybody else followed, that you could reinvent what a life was supposed to be like. I think we called it stone thinking at the time, but we were stoned. It seems logical. Anyway, so that was it suited how I already looked at things in a way. After graduating from Cal, I traveled around Europe and I came back. I don't know who else goes to college and never thinks about for a minute what they're going to do after college, except take a trip, and then goes away for 3 months and never thinks about what they're going to do when they get back from their trip. I remember getting to the airport in Lisbon and saying, "Where should I fly to?" I didn't want to go to Chicago where my family was. I didn't want to go to LA where a lot of my friends moved back to. And so I came back to Northern California. And I like to say that I did postgraduate work in softball and frisbee. Since no career occurred to me, I just got by and lived one day at a time. And at some point I realized that I could make jewelry and sell it at Christmas time, and that it would pay my rent for the year. This was trouble. It wasn't trouble exactly, but it kind of freed me up from that whole career thing. You know, and Ed always gets a kick out of my revelation at age 22 that that everybody works so hard for so long in their life, and then they retire when they get to be 65 or 70, that why shouldn't I just take my 20s off? And I kind of had a means to do that now. I was a hippie, and I was supporting myself, and nothing occurred to me that I really wanted to do. And it seems that around this time, I started to codify what was easy into a philosophy. In other words, because it was easy and it agreed with me, I said, I wasn't just escaping from something, I was actually deciding that this was my path. And in a way, I was probably avoiding difficult choices, and I probably lacked the courage to really sit down and decide what I wanted to do. But I used to like to think, well, I guess I still think this, that that I lack ambition, but when opportunity knocks, I'll open the door. So that's about the extent of my how I've lived my whole life, in that I've never said, I really want to do that, and then worked hard at it. I've always just said, if somebody offers me something and it seems like a good idea, I'll do it. In fact, the making jewelry happened because I had a girlfriend that I went to Europe with who, when we broke up, left her jewelry tools in a little orange box in my house. And I said, oh, what's this? And so I've been making jewelry for 40 years because she left that instead of printmaking or whatever else she might have been doing. One day on Monday, was it Monday night or Tuesday night that Lou's class always existed? Was it?
It started on Tuesday night.
Okay. All right. One Tuesday night, Peter Coyote read a poem, and then when I told him I loved it, he sent it to me. And I'll read it twice for you, Michael. I'm never lost in forest or town because I never care where I am. If you have time to chatter, read books. If you have time to read, walk into mountains, desert, and ocean. If you have time to walk, sing songs and dance. If you have time to dance, sit quietly, you happy, lucky idiot. This was Sakaki, a Japanese poet. You want me to read it again, or are you okay with once?
I heard it again.
Okay. I'm never lost in forest or town because I never care where I am. If you have time to chatter, read books. If you have time to read, walk into mountain, desert, and ocean. If you have time to walk, sing songs and dance. If you have time to dance, sit quietly, you happy, lucky idiot. I don't know why it resonated for me, but it did.
Yeah, right. Thank you.
Sure. And it would be probably interesting to say that taking my 20s off was full of hardship and anguish, but you know what? It was really a great idea, and I had a lot of fun, and a lot of solitude because people seemed to be working during the day. It was the weirdest thing. I remember Thursdays, the New Yorker would come, and people would say, what are you doing today? It's Thursday. I've got the New Yorker to read. But mostly I read novels, and it seemed to me that Joan Didion was right. She wrote in Slouching Toward Bethlehem that people live by platitudes. And I discovered that there's plenty of great wisdom out there, offered by poets and philosophers, enlightened beings, and experience. And if it resonates, grab it as it floats by, try it on, let it sink in, make a commitment to it, and make it your intention. And not able to come up with that much original thought, I've collected those. Anybody who knows, I'm always coming up with some aphorism because I collect these things in my head, and I try to have them inform my thoughts and actions. We're not talking about 100% success rate, but it's at least it's an intention to do the right thing. Luckily, where I was living in San Francisco, I had rent control, and I had a good location not far from North Beach, and this allowed me to push the limits of pre-adulthood all the way through my 20s. When I made the original deal to take my 20s off, I said, when I'm 30, I'm going to get a job. I mean, open-ended playfulness. I mean, who could do that? So I did get, I did start working as a graphic designer at 30, and I, am I going long? I just go like this one, I'm going too slow.
You have about 10 more minutes.
Okay.
Because we're going to leave some time for some questions.
Okay, I'm getting close. I met Sarah when I was 32, and as an art major, she luckily found my lifestyle acceptable. And a year into our relationship, when the end seemed imminent, an old friend suggested that maybe I was sabotaging relationships. She seemed to have lots of evidence that I dated people, something went wrong, what was it? She said, were they all bad people? I said, no, they were great people. What happened? I don't know, but she suggested an experiment. She said, be nice, no sarcasm, just 1 week, can you do it, right? I said, I can do it for a week. I've been keeping kosher for 40 years. I can be nice for 1 week. Apparently that earlier lesson in high school when my girlfriend said, you're not nice, hadn't really sunk in. And but anyways, I got a second chance. And I got a second chance to learn the lesson, and I got a second chance with Sarah. And be nice, I tried it. It was kind of heady stuff. It was, it felt good to do it, and it worked. And wow, God, it felt good to be nice, you know? And of course, maybe it harkened back to St. Francis, who said, it is in giving that we receive. And at this point, I was so grateful that it worked. I think maybe it was starting to sink in. I was talking to my daughter the other day about relationships, and she said, how did you and Mommy get together? And I said, I'll tell you how. On our first date, I went to her apartment, and she needed to paint her apartment, and I offered to help paint it. And she never got over that. It's a recommendation if anybody ever gets the opportunity. The next major thing that happened was when we had our first child, I also realized that no matter how hard the husband can try, the mom does all the heavy lifting. And asking what can I do to help is really the least you can do. There's really no getting even. Making a cup of tea at 3 a.m. doesn't really compare to pregnancy and childbirth. So there's a moment that you feel it's so liberating to be so in debt to a spouse or a friend that you no longer have to calculate, that giving and receiving become the same thing. You just are so, please let me do something, you know, because you're never going to catch up anyway. And you never have to think about it again. And it's just, okay, what can I do to help? There's another poem for you, Michael. It's from a Sufi poet named Hafez. It goes like this. Even after all this time, the sun never says to the earth, you owe me. Look what happens to a love like that. It lights up the whole sky. I'll say it one more time, Michael. Even after all this time, the sun never says to the earth, you owe me. Look what happens to a love like that. It lights up the whole sky. Anyway, soon after Julian was born, I was required to get an MRI to diagnose some neurological problems that I was having. It was thought to be MS, and leaving the neurologist's office, I got on a bus heading for UCSF. You know, I could have gotten the test another time, but I didn't want to wait and think about it. And an amazing thing kind of happened on the bus. Here I was sitting there terrified about what was happening to my life and what might be happening in my life. And I was just sitting on the Muni bus heading to UCSF, and I had this, I call it the compassion epiphany. And I just felt like I could look at everybody on the bus and say, how are they suffering? What is their pain? Everybody must, maybe not everybody, but I just had this moment of feeling compassion for strangers. And I think that in a way was one of the first things that this diagnosis wound up having effect on me. The second thing that I remember about it was when you get in an MRI machine, you are surrounded by this giant metal thing. And it seemed like it took 2 hours, but I'm not really sure. But I was so grateful for the refuge I felt of meditation and prayer that, you know, sitting there for 2 hours and not getting hysterical, I was very grateful that I had had some kind of practice that I could, help me through the tedium of it and the fear, and also help to deal with the what-ifs involved. Where am I? So the diagnosis was correct. I had MS. The neurologist, who I always call the most useless doctors in the world, suggested try not to be too stressed out. So you just got a diagnosis that could be wheelchair in a year, could be nothing, could whatever, and there's no medication and there's no treatment, and they don't say, you might think about therapy, you might think about joining a group. They just say, don't be stressed out. Okay. But I felt luckier than most because I already had some practice. I already practiced, I meditated some more, I kind of did visual guided imagery, I'd like to call it, you know, where I just imagined that I was going to be healthy. It isn't much of a scientific study. It worked fairly well. Who can say? I also felt very grateful for knowing that whatever happened, I had my friends and my family to support me, and this the Sangha refuge, the knowing that you weren't going to be alone. And meanwhile, I like to think that I'm grateful every day that it hasn't really affected my life in too negative of a way, and also grateful for the lessons that it afforded me. I think that it has made me more compassionate, and also it allowed me to be the recipient of other people's kindness. When Julian and Nina were little, I started to go to Spirit Rock to meditate and hear Sylvia Borstein and Jack Kornfield give Dharma talks. The Vipassana practice, with its emphasis on Dharma and loving kindness, compassion, forgiveness, gratitude, I couldn't wait to digest the teachings. I still listen to these talks online and I'm always moved by their warm-heartedness and their, and I'm grateful for their guidance. In 2006, I came to Tuesday night for the first time with Lou, and luckily it was the first night back by Elizabeth, who's off to LA to see some boyfriend today. And she had been treated for cancer, and she came back to the Sangha, and she was welcomed, and she, the way that the Sangha felt about her and the way she appreciated how much the Sangha had done for her when she was sick, moved me so much that I felt like, you know, there's an expression, you had me at a low. Well, the Sangha, I was sold on the Sangha from the first moment before we did our first meditation, when everybody just said, when Elizabeth said, you guys were there for me, you helped me through this. I said, I'll take a ticket on this bus. Okay, I'm gonna wrap up a little bit with another line from everybody's favorite optimist, Franz Kafka. Goes, it is not necessary that you leave the house. Remain at your table and listen. Do not even listen, only wait. Do not even wait. Be wholly still and alone. The world will present itself to you for its unmasking. It can do no other. In ecstasy, it will writhe at your feet. Again? Mm-hmm. This is Franz Kafka now, not known for upbeat stuff. It is not necessary that you leave the house. Remain at your table and listen. Do not even listen, only wait. Do not even wait. Be wholly still and alone. The world will present itself to you for its unmasking. You can do no other. In ecstasy, it will writhe at your feet. Questions? Yeah.
Thank you so much.
You're welcome.
You so achieved 1,000 joys, 1,000 sorrows, and 3 refuges. Really meant a lot. A lot of sadness, or just how to live in the world. I mean, I think there's so much suffering in living in the world for me. My question is, you gave such a complete talk, and it was such wholehearted giving. My question is, what was the nervousness that led you to always say no when asked to give your talk?
Oh, you know what? Part of it was I felt guilty that, I think I've been coming for 6 years, longer than that. And there were a lot of years when I came more often than Ed, because I was coming 2 times a week, when there was just 2 of us, or you and. But I always felt that everybody in the group was so open about their personal lives, their suffering, and I felt that I had kept, like the fact that I have MS, a secret. And for whatever reason, as time went by, I felt more guilty about not having shared some of these things about my life. And the idea of actually doing it was A, difficult, and B, embarrassing, that everybody else felt that they could say stuff, and I was still feeling too private or withholding. And so that kind of was the reason. And I don't do public speaking besides. Anything else? Barbara?
I wanted to tell you that you've been one of my greatest teachers in the Sangha.
Thank you.
And I said that when I gave my talk, because you really practice kindness. I mean, you don't seem that way. Well, I just think I call you to my family the smart-ass kid, like I taught. You know, you just always have, and you're like one of my sons. But, I mean, I have Brian as, well, not quite equal to you, but near.
Thank you.
And, that's a compliment. And I've just learned from you, and you're always doing it, and you're listening to programs, and my mom had MS, so I think people who have MS are real heroes. So thank you for finally telling us
thank you.
Your story.
Question. Thank you so much.
Sure.
I loved your story, and it's been so nice to see you both here in the Sangha and also at the farmer's market. That was a little happenstance. I'm curious, Gary, about when you were in your 20s and you were having a great time and you were waiting to decide on a career, was it hard for you, or was your family after you, or were you able to just say, no, this is what I want to do, or in spite of, or were they supportive of you? I guess that's my question.
I was going to bring a picture of what I looked like in college. I had a beard and a ponytail, and my parents called me the cockroach for a number of years, but in the most loving way. And when I finished college and waited tables for a while and then eventually started selling jewelry at Fisherman's Wharf, I don't think it was fulfilling their utmost dreams for me. But I... I felt good about having a good time. I felt good about, here's a thought that I had when I was young. I said, money buys freedom. And people who make a lot of money, have taller fences, bigger houses, longer vacations. And then I thought that, well, maybe you can get to the freedom part without the money part. And I thought of myself as independently poor all those years, because my apartment was $80 on Sacramento Street, and I met my friends for coffee at Mario's every day, and I had found a way to have everything without the work part. The work that I did do was I enjoyed. I love schmoozing out on the wherever I'm selling, and also. There was always a sense when I was growing up that it wasn't how much you made, it was how you beat the game. You know what I mean? I don't applaud this, but my father, in a way, even said, if you can work really, really hard and get an A, and do no work and get a B, I don't know, I'd go for the B. And now, so this is not a great lesson. And I didn't want to teach it to my kids. But I did it anyway. By example, we say, in our family, we say the nut doesn't fall far from the nut tree. But I just never saw the purpose in sacrificing the good for the perfect, And what other people's ideas of what makes you happy just didn't necessarily make me happy. And being free to come and go and to take trips and I don't know, it worked for me. And you know what, I never really grew up out of that. It's like even now I sell jewelry once a week and yes, I'm lucky that my wife works. I mentioned that she works, but she's cool with it. So I didn't feel overly guilty. I was having too much fun.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Amy. So yeah. What role, Gary, does Judaism now play in your spiritual life?
As a Jubu, I feel like people ask me, do I go to high holiday services? And I don't anymore. Because I often feel that when I go to temple, I feel less spiritual when I leave than when I came. So for the high holidays, I go to Point Reyes. That's our usual family tradition. I'm grateful to the Judaism part for putting me on the path of ritual, of prayer and self-control and all the other things I mentioned that I got from those early days. We were at a bat mitzvah recently and the Torah portion was so-and-so, the rabbi smoting, killing somebody for their trans, whatever. And I said, I remember saying to the rabbi, how could we teach this? Where is the loving kindness? Where is the forgiveness? And he said, well, you're supposed to discuss it. I said, no, this is not what happens when you read it and translate it in front of the group, the congregation. You're saying that it's okay to be vengeful and and violent, you know, where I don't even want to hear it, you know. I want to hear him saying, and they forgave them, and they became friends. I think the problems in the Middle East would be lessened if everybody invited somebody to dinner. So the answer is, I'm grateful for my Jewish history, but I'm looking for a kinder path. Yes?
I want to say thank you so much for speaking. In the time that I've been here in the Sangha, I wanted to know you more, have a conversation with you, but we had one small conversation and I felt guilty after the conversation. I should have known not to. It was when I told you that I did graphic design for the theater. I did it as a volunteer, and you said it's people like you that take the jobs.
Oh, God Almighty, I was kidding. That's the problem sometimes is I'll say something to be funny, as you know, and people misunderstand that I...
Yeah.
Really.
I just really appreciate everything that you said. You're opening your heart.
Right. Thank you.
In such a wonderful way. It really was, I don't know why, but I feel so moved by it. And we have a lot of similar things. So thank you.
You're welcome.
It was lovely.
Thanks. Now I'm sad Sarah missed it. She thought she was going to make me nervous to...
No.
Maybe she would.
Okay, what was really... One of the things that was really lovely that did bring tears was your discussion of the mother, you know, and your relationship, or what you realized.
Mm-hmm.
That was very lovely.
You know, in summary a little bit, you know... If we generally, all our actions, you know, generally they're about getting something or getting ahead or accomplishing something or checking off lists on our list of things we have to do today. And not that I accomplished this, but if you think about just doing things, what is the nice thing to do? You know, what is the, would seem like that's all you have to do is just figure out what is the nice thing to do, you know?
This is really a lesson for me. I'm so glad to hear all of that, because I churn. This is wonderful, Gary.
No churning.
You can give lessons. Come back.
Well, you're always giving us lessons.
When you come back from Bristol.
Okay.
We should probably end now so people can express their appreciation to Gary after we close.
That was enough appreciation.
Thank you very much for finally coming forward. Very much appreciated. And is this your last time? Are you going to be gone now?
Yeah, we're leaving Sunday.
This Sunday?
You're welcome. Thank you. We're leaving Sunday for Bristol, England. Sarah got a job writing a TV show for Discovery Channel. And so it just came up all of a sudden. So they offered her a job, airfare, apartment, per diem, and...
You have to do it.
You know, it's like, you know, and just, oh my God, I won't be able to work. And now some people would be freaked out about this, but as you know, I'll probably be able to just ease into it the best I can. And I'm going, and there's a meditation class. There's meditation classes all over Bristol, and there's a university there. Maybe I'll take some poetry classes. I had a note in here. I wanted to thank Gib for teaching me that there is poetry beyond haiku. not that there's anything wrong with haiku, but there are other things.
Gary.
Yeah.
How do we get your book?
Oh, there's been a rumor going around that that I would make a blog and have some comments about having nothing to do for 4 months. You know, I did it for 10 years. I could do it for 4 months. And I have everybody's email, so I'll email people.
You'll send us the...
I'll send you a... If I can figure out... If my daughter can teach me how to do a blog, I'll send everybody a link to how to find it.
Would you tell them the first thing going on your blog?
Okay. And although I'm not actually there yet, I've written my first entry. It's a haiku. I've been doing a little bit of research about Bristol, and my first entry on the blog is going to be a haiku. It goes like this. Rain, 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 rain. So if you see that, sorry, you've already heard the first one.
So can you also give me your address? I will mail you a CD so Sarah can actually listen to this.
Yeah, right. She wrote the script. I know. All she wants to know is how I presented her script.
How well it came across. Came across beautifully.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you.
So let's stand up and bow.